This is the story of the one. As head of maintenance at a concert hall, he knows the show must always go on. That's why he works behind the scenes, ensuring every light is working, the HVAC is humming, and his facility shines. With Grainger's supplies and solutions for every challenge he faces, plus 24/7 customer support, his venue never misses a beat. Call quickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
You're listening to a Weeby Geeks Network podcast.
Another world, another time, in the age of wonder.
There was once a dream. You could only whisper it. Anything more than a whisper, and it would vanish.
A battle between good and evil.
You don't know the power of the dark side.
Where shall I find a new adversary so close to my own level?
Try the local sewer.
You know of the rebellion against the Empire?
The Avengers, Earth's Mightiest Heroes.
Peace means having a bigger stick than the other guy.
One of these days, I'm gonna have a stick of my own.
I'm Groot.
Welcome to the Neverland Podcast. The podcast for lovers of Disney, Pixar, Marvel, and Star Wars.
I'm glad you're here to tell us these things.
Please welcome your host, Jeremy.
I thought he'd be taller.
Yeah, I can fly.
All it takes is faith.
Rust. Well, if it isn't the Star Spangled Man with a plan, what is your plan today?
Up to Neverland!
I know what you're thinking. You're expecting me to say something about pixies and pockets and all that. Well, I'm going to end up saying that a little bit later because this is a very special episode this week. This episode was recorded live from Planet Comic-Con, Kansas City, Missouri, 2019. This, of course, I've been talking about for weeks. This was coming up. Lost Boy Eric was unable to fly in, so Lost Boy Philip and I did this panel, and we talked about all of the artists that work with Walt Disney at Laugh-O-Gram Studios and what became of them. And you can kind of see that Walt Disney's influence may have had an effect on all of the animation that really kind of came out in that era. So it's a very fascinating panel. People really seem to have enjoyed it. I got to meet a couple of new people who really liked it. There's one lady that's dressed as She-Ra. Hello, I'm pretty sure she's listening. I think she said her name was Tara. I'm trying to remember. She actually helped me find a Mickey Mouse Funko Pop of the Brave Little Taylor. I actually, at this convention, I found a lot of the Mickey Mouse Funko Pops. They're really adorable. I've got a Plain Crazy one now, and also one from the band concert. So I am very happy with the ones I have, adding that to my Steamboat Willie one. I had a great time at this convention. Paige O'Hara was there at the convention, the voice of Belle from Beauty and the Beast. I couldn't find her. When it came time, I was going to go and have her sign something. Couldn't find her at her booth. She wasn't there. But I did manage to get a comic book signed by Spider-Man artist. Well, he's been an artist for a lot of stuff in Marvel, but I've always liked his work on Spider-Man. But Mark Bagley was there, and so I had him sign and personalize a comic. It was a free comic book day version of Ultimate Spider-Man number one. And even the very first Spider-Man comic I bought with my own money was something that he had drawn that issue. And I remember it's a Shocker issue, and he drew Shocker on the cover fighting Spider-Man. And so that was pretty exciting for me to have that signed. I got to go to quite a few panels. Got a few photos of some cosplayers. It's all going to be up on the website, neverlandpodcast.com. All the photos of Mick Foley and Wallace Shawn, you know, and some of the panels I went to. Of course, that's audio I'm going to share with you when I get a chance to, because it's good stuff. There might even be some things I release a little early to my Patreon supporters. In fact, I have video of the panel, and I plan on releasing that one a little early to the Patreon support, so you all get to look at a video. of the panel when you also get to hear, you know, the audio in this week's episode. But I have the video up there for you. I may even copy the notes over for a special thing for some Patreon supports. I don't know. We'll see, because I'm keeping the notes, and we signed a couple copies of our notes and gave them to a couple of people who attended the panel, and everybody seemed to have enjoyed the panel, so it's great audio. So I'm going to share that with you right now. But after the panel audio is over, don't go anywhere, because we also happen to have had a new Disney release this week, Dumbo, the live-action remake, and I will have my review for you at the end of the show. I would have maybe done it before the panel audio, but because I kind of mention it at the end of the panel and I talk about it a little bit, I thought it would be good to just go ahead and do the review and talk about it at the towards the end of the show after the panel audio. So, without too much more talking from me, I want to thank everybody who came to the panel. If you happen to be now listening to this episode because you came and enjoyed the panel, thank you for attending. I always love doing it. I love it when people do show up and enjoy and have a good time. And I did hear it circulated a little bit. Somebody else even coming to me later says, oh, wow, I'm really hearing the good things about your panel. People really enjoyed that. So I really appreciate that. Even over at the Thank You Walt Disney booth, I think is where somebody was telling me, they're like, yo, I heard about your panel and I hear people really liked it. So I really appreciate that. So anyways, here is the audio of said panel. And of course, like I said, stick around for a Dumbo review. Don't forget.
To Disney and beyond.
Start him up.
Okay. Who's the leader of the club? Who's made for you and me? Say it again.
M-I-C-A-Y-L-O-U-S-E.
Oh, great. What was that? Watch your mouth now. I like your shirt, by the way, Mrs.
Yeah,
Mickey
Mouse. Fun.
That's wonderful. I like all your shirts. I see Superman out here.
Yeah.
I'm fanatical about that. I love it. I see Wolverine out here. Bub, as you said earlier.
Oh, yeah.
I see Spawn. I see a whole lot of stuff I like. That's wonderful.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
That's wonderful.
And, of course, he's a Superman fan. His Lost Boy nickname is Kryptonian.
You can't tell, but I'm wearing Superman right now, just underneath some things. That's wonderful.
Yeah. And just to kind of get everybody informed while we're still waiting, I got 3 minutes before I'll actually start anything with the really good stuff, because people are still wandering in. But basically, I started the Neverland podcast 6 years ago. I've now updated towards Neverland to Disney and beyond, because we frequently go outside Disney a little bit, because I figure if you're listening in and you like animation, you might like How to Train Your Dragon, so I want to be able to talk about that as well. Or if you like Marvel movies, you probably like some DC movies. I mean, they can't all be, Batman v Superman and be that wonderful. But Aquaman was awesome. I'm excited
yes.
for Shazam, and I want to be able to talk about it on the show, so I give myself that little bit of leeway. Although I do notice, like, sometimes my download numbers, I see a drop when I talk about something, and I put the title and it's non-Disney. They instantly assume, I don't want to hear anybody talk about Disney, because there are people who are so obsessed that they don't like anything else. I'm like, well, that's fine, but I still put a good show for you, and I'm still going to talk some Disney in there. So, but anyways, how I was referring to him as the Kryptonian, every Lost Boy or Pixie, girls are too clever, they don't get lost. That's from the book. So all you ladies can become Pixies, all you guys can become Lost Boys, but you have to have a nickname. So your nickname has to describe you. We call him Kryptonian because he is such a Superman junkie. And I'm the head Lost Boy, which makes me the Pan. I got Pan sore. I'm the Pan now. Thank you, Rufio. I'm a big Spider-Man junkie, so I'm the Spider-Pan. See? So you get something clever. If you go to our website, neverlandpodcast.com, you click on the thing in the menu of Neverlanders, you can actually send a little email and why you want to be nicknamed and what you want to be nicknamed, and we get you on the list and we add to our army of Neverlanders out there, of Pixies and Lost Boys, and we have a good time. But, of course, the theme of our show is spreading pixie dust, which is that young at heart, positive attitude, and you got to keep that, and you keep your pixie in your pocket. That's another thing we say. We keep your pixie in your pocket. That way, whenever you need somebody, you see somebody needs a little pixie dust, you pull your pixie out and say, here, shake it out there. So that's how that works. So, and basically, how that translates in real life is, you see somebody having a bad day, just go, sometimes, hey, how you doing? Smile at them.
Gray skies are going to clear up.
Be sincere, right? Yeah. Gray skies, it can't rain all the time.
That's right. Put on a happy face.
Yeah. Are we already rolling back there? Because it's about 10:30. We're rolling?
Yeah, we are rolling now.
Awesome. So I'm going to start this way. I started. What?
That's some good stuff, so.
Yeah. Well, good. I'm glad it's good stuff. I haven't even gotten started. We're not even doing the good stuff. But I start every show like this. Take your pixie out of your pocket. Spread a little bit of that pixie dust. Think of that happiest thought. Let's fly away to Neverland. I, of course, will be your guide. Who am I? The head Lost Boy. The Spider Pan. Because somebody has to be the Pan until Peter comes back. I don't know what happened to the guy. I think he became a lawyer. Who knows? I heard he might even be dead. I'll have to ask Blaine Weaver. I'm one of these days, I'm going to have Blaine Weaver on. If you don't know who that is, he's the current voice, like, in the parks. He also did Return to Neverland, which I fell asleep trying to watch when I borrowed that for
now. That's a good show.
It's a little embarrassing, the guy who has a show called Neverland, that I fall asleep during one of the movies.
No, it's a good one.
It's pretty good. It's not as good as the original.
Well, you can't beat that.
Yeah. But anyway, so that's how I started every show, but I did a lot of research. This is my fourth year out here. First year, we had a couple of people from Marceline come down from the Walt Disney Hometown Museum. Lots of fun. We went over pretty much everything Walt has done other than, of course, living there. And every time he comes back to Marceline, he's brought stuff. Had a great time talking about some early history of Walt. Then the following year, my co-host Eric was here. Unfortunately, he couldn't be here this year. He couldn't get a flight. We talked about the Laugh-O-Gram Studios and had some nice video of it. And talked about all the different things that happened at Laugh-O-Gram. But what I haven't covered yet and what we're going to do today is there was a lot of artists that Walt met here and worked with him at Laugh-O-Gram Studios that went on to do amazing things. We were almost the hub of animation here in Kansas City if the Laugh-O-Gram Studio had not have failed. But if we didn't have, if Laugh-O-Gram hadn't failed, we wouldn't have had the Disney company. We'd have Laugh-O-Gram, probably. But Roy would not have been involved, and Walt still wouldn't probably have any good business sense to be able to keep his company going. So if you have never seen where Laugh-O-Gram is at, out here on 31st Street, you head towards Troost. It's like a block away from Troost. You'll see a building that has a big sign that says, "Thank you, Walt Disney." Has
your pixie's talking.
Why are my in-laws calling? We're going to do this. We're going to do this. Hi! Hello? Yeah, that's me. Hi, you're talking to an entire crowd I'm looking at.
You're what?
We're out here at Planet Comic Con. We're going to talk to some Walt Disney artists, and I forgot to turn my phone off.
Oh, okay. Well, if you'd rather call me back later, then sorry.
Okay, but say hi to everybody. Everybody say hi, Mrs.
Hi.
Billups. Okay, all right, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
See, I actually like my mother-in-law because she's cool. My bad, okay. I'm totally leaving that in my recording of the show.
And I even told you.
Yeah, I was even talking to you earlier, so yeah, make sure to turn it off. Okay, what was I? Oh, yeah, so you'll see a building. It has, let's say, Thank You, Walt Disney, and it has, like, drawings from something, because United Features, it's actually here in Kansas City, so there's a lot of their artists have come in, so Ziggy's drawn on there, and I think, like, Beetle Bailey, but that's the actual building, and they're trying to actually get it rebuilt for Laugh-O-Gram Studios. And if you keep going down 31st Street and go down Bellefontaine, now it's a one-way come the opposite direction, but there's this brown house kind of near the corner, and that's where the Disney family lived.
It's ringing.
Oh, sorry. I'm going to adjust. That's where the Disney family lived after they moved here when Walt's about 9 years old from Marceline. So, but then we got to advance some history and some of these other people that Walt met, that these are some pioneers of animation. Some of these names you're going to know. Some of these names you're going to be like, I don't know who that is, but when we start talking about what they've done, you're going to be like, oh my gosh, I love you. So, but we'll start with Hugh Harmon. I'm going to see who people feel like. I'm gonna look at faces, because if I say a name and somebody goes like, I'm gonna be like, those are my peoples. So, but Hugh Harmon was born August 31st, 1903 in Pagosa Springs, California. Or not California, Colorado. Sorry, I'm already messing my words up. So he actually tried to start his own studio after Laugh-O-Gram failed with Carmen Maxwell and Rudolph Ising. Now we're gonna hear those names later on. You're also gonna find out why they failed. There was a project they were trying to do, we'll talk about later. So when that fails, he did hear back from Walt, and we're getting to get some details on what Walt starts doing in California. But he hears from Walt, and he's going to start working with somebody named Charles Mintz and Margaret Winkler. So Walt sends out notifications. So Hugh Harmon is one of the people who went back to work in California and starts working on the Alice comedies and also Oswald the Lucky Rabbit, which if some of you are not familiar with him, we're going to get you. Oh, she knows Oswald. That's awesome. Woo-hoo! So he continued to actually produce Oswald cartoons with Rudolph Ising, which actually developed their particular style, which they would, both of them would later carry on over at Warner Brothers. And 1 year later, though, he kept working under Charles Mintz, and actually Charles Mintz kept him on after he took Oswald away from Walt, and this is when he starts really developing that style. And about a year later that he's working with Charles Mintz, he got replaced by Walter Lance. Anybody know the name Walter Lance? for Woody Woodpecker fans out there. Now, Walter Lantz never worked with Walt, but I have seen some quotes from him where he does credit a lot of his style to Walt Disney. So with Ising, Rudolph Ising, and a few other former Disney animators, and with producer Leon Schlesinger, you're going to know his name very well later, created a pilot for Bosco the Talk Ink Kid.
Bosco!
Yeah, Bosco was one of those very early, very round-headed little monkey characters that was, for a while, he was the very first of the Looney Tunes, but later they took that character over to MGM. We'll bring up some of that later, so I won't get into it too far. But Hugh Harmon, in 1939, was working for MGM. He took Bosco with him in 1934 over to Bosco, because he was previously under contract with Warner Brothers. But he got nominated for an Oscar in an anti-war cartoon called Peace on Earth. So here you are. You're at the cusp of World War II starting, and he's trying to put a thing out for peace, because we really were trying to have peace here in the United States, and then Japan ruined that for us. The cartoon actually featured two squirrels commenting on the evils of humanity, which was probably, I would like to see this. I wonder if he was commenting on some of the evils he was seeing going on in Europe, because things were starting to heat up over there in 1939. So 1940, here we go. I was actually just watching a video on YouTube I need to show you about Hanna-Barbera, but 1940, he was the producer on Hanna-Barbera's first cartoon, Puss Gets the Boot. Anyone want to take a guess who this introduced the world to? Two big characters. Yes, Tom and Jerry. Puss Gets the Boots, the very first Tom and Jerry cartoon. This actually launches the career of Hanna-Barbera. So, you have Hugh Harmon, who develops an animation style working with Walt, later on starts working with these Hanna-Barbera guys, and gets their career launched. So, perhaps without Walt Disney's influence, maybe we wouldn't even have Hanna-Barbera? That's speculation, but you can see there, it's all connected. It's very interesting. In 1941, Hugh Harmon left MGM, and he joined, actually, with Disney veteran Mel Shaw and formed their own studio in of Iwerks' old studio, created in military training cartoons, which happened a lot in the 40s. You know, Walt's, his entire studio turned into a, you know, military propaganda thing. They turned his entire studio into an army base, pretty much. We'll get into a lot more details on of Iwerks' studio later on when we talk about So, Rudolph Ising.
Yes, so Rudolph Ising, after Laugh-O-Gram, after it failed the studio creation attempt, went to Harmon back to work with Disney on Oswald cartoons and the Alice comedies. They continued working with Mintz after Oswald was taken away from Walt. And after leaving Universal Studios with Mintz, he and Harmon went to Warner Brothers and began to work on Bosco, which launched the Looney Tunes series. Now, I think you might have heard of Looney Tunes. Maybe I'm wrong about that. Anyone here ever heard of Looney Tunes? Yeah, I think so. Me too. Just a few. I don't know. I might be wrong about that. They also started Merry Melodies, which, of course, is a part of the Looney Tunes. We know
right.
that. Merry Melodies in parody, we believe, of Walt's Silly Symphonies. Or that might just be utilizing the popularity of them.
Yeah, some websites that I was scanning doing my research said that it called the Looney Tunes and Merry Melodies was definitely a parody of Silly Symphonies, because Walt Disney had already developed a name for himself. But Jim Corcus, if anybody knows that guy, I mean, he is a walking, I've had him on the show, he's so awesome. I sent him my notes for any corrections, and he says, well, we don't know that really it was parody, it was probably just utilizing the fact that everybody heard of Silly Symphony, so they figured if they did a similar name, they might gain some of that popularity and pull something away from Walt.
Yeah, we see that a lot even now,
yeah.
Those types of things. They are frequent accused of copying Disney's style. This parody title may have something to do with it.
Yeah, when you kind of align yourself too close to Walt, everybody's going to be like, you're trying to be Walt Disney, aren't you?
That's right. They worked on Silly Symphony Mer-Babies. Thank you.
That's a hard word.
Yes, it is. While Walt's animators were working on Snow White. You may have heard that movie, too. I don't know. It didn't do too well,
kind
I don't
of,
think.
Kind of a thing.
That's right.
Still vibrating.
1931, Merry Melodies, Smile Darn You Smile.
I wonder if anybody from that, does that click and ring any bells, anybody?
Yeah, that's right. The theme song.
We got a guy back here, he knows it.
Yeah, the theme song of this short was used in Who Framed Roger Rabbit. Do you all remember that movie, Who Framed Roger mm-hmm. Rabbit? One of my favorites.
I have a hard time in the movie actually hearing the lyrics, but Disney Indiana, the podcast I like to listen to, plays a version of it. Everybody apparently really loved this song, and so many people re-recorded Smile, Darn You Smile from this cartoon. But this is a song, Smile, Darn You Smile. You know this whole world is a great world after all.
Take it, bud.
If nobody else sings with me, I'm going to stop.
But smile,
yeah, I'll sing, Darn You Smile. And right away, let Lady Luck pay you a call. Things are never dark as they are painted. Time for you and Joy to get acquainted. were smiling back, and some of you are like, please stop singing.
You did good. You did good.
I used to never, like, in the last scene of Roger Rabbit, when all the cartoons bust through the wall and they're all singing it, I could never understand the lyric to it, though.
Yeah, I mean, well, there's so much going on.
So much going on, but that's what they're singing, and it is a great little song. I like it.
It is, but I leave it up to the singing sword, Frank Sinatra. You know what you're going to do.
Yeah.
I love Sinatra, baby. But that being said, that's a great song, Smile, Darn You, Smile. It's drawn by Ive Freeling and Maxwell, which is hard for me to say.
Yeah, Maxwell. Well, he's Cormac Maxwell is his full name, but he went by Max. We're going to talk about him later, too.
Yes, that's right. Who we'll meet later, as you just said.
Yeah.
In 1933, after falling out with Leon Schlesinger at Warner Brothers, that's hard for me to say, too, took Bosco to MGM since he and Harmon held the copyright.
Now, he probably learned that trick from Walt. Because Walt, when he created Oswald the Lucky Rabbit, he did it under contract from Charles Mintz. So Charles Mintz actually had legal rights to take that character away and leave Walt with nothing. But thank you, because without that, we wouldn't have Mickey Mouse. So, nee-nee-nee-nee-neener. But I figure, you know, Harmon and Ising had to have seen what happened and said, okay, we're going to create this character Bosco, but we make sure we keep the rights. So when they leave Warner Brothers, they're taking that character with them. So no, that's ours. We created him. We own the copyright. Warner Brothers, screw you guys. We'll be back later, though. They went over to MGM with Bosco. So I figured they had to have known that happened to Walt. I'm like, uh-huh.
And then created 37 happy harmonies, and that does sound a lot like the Silly Symphony.
Yeah, they put a lot of them under the label Harmonizing, which I always thought was cute because they're harmonizing. So.
It is. So they created 37 happy harmonies. In 1938, they were terminated from MGM. And there was a subcontracted for 1 year. They also began some work with Disney on Silly Symphonies.
That's when they did that Merbabies, was when they started subcontracting, because they had their own company Harmonizing, so they're not working at MGM, but they can subcontract. They still did a little bit of stuff for MGM, and they did some work on Silly Symphonies like the Merbabies, because all of Walt's animators were busy with Snow White. So
they then hired back at MGM after that year, after Disney, and they reneged on a deal to release two Harmonizing cartoons, which were later sold to Fred Quimby.
Fred Quimby, is a name you might be familiar with.
Oh, yes.
I mean, he's at the tail end of a lot of... I think he was mainly with MGM, because I know he was associated with... he did some stuff with Hanna-Barbera. I should have looked up some stuff on him, but he's not from Kansas City, so...
Ising and Harmon then separated, from what I understand.
Yep.
1940, they won an Oscar for The Milky Way. I don't know if anyone's ever seen that. Anyone ever seen The Milky Way cartoon?
Yeah, this would be specifically Rudolph Ising, though, that he won his Oscar in 1940 for that.
Yeah, great, great cartoon. I've seen it. It's a very good one.
This first one Disney didn't win.
Yeah, that's... Can you imagine that? After all those years, and Disney won Oscar after Oscar after Oscar.
Then suddenly here comes, oh, hey, that guy used to work with me, and he took my Oscar.
And then
I'm sure he was happy for
it. Oh, I'm sure he was, but not happy for himself. In 1942, he left MGM to serve in the military during World War II, and you have to commend him for that,
yeah,
to serve in the military in World War II. And then 1951, Harmon and Ising produced Good Wrinkles to support California prune industry.
And we speculate that might have had some influence on the California raises later. We just thought that was interesting. Look, a prune cartoon. Maybe that's where you might have to do something with raisins.
They heard it through the prune vine.
They might have. Now, one thing we do want to kind of mention is, I forgot to bring this up after I was going through Hugh Harmon, but Hugh Harmon had a brother, Fred Harmon, who did a little bit of work with Laugh-O-Gram, but he didn't go on into animation. He instead started drawing his own comic strip by the name of Red Ryder.
Anyone ever heard of Red Ryder? He had a very famous BB gun.
Uh-huh.
Maybe you've ever watched The Christmas Story. He also had a very famous, at the time, candy bar known as the Action Bar. And I don't know if you ever heard of that. There was also a loaf of bread that you could get that looked like it was coming in a wagon like you have back in the West. Now, I personally know all this simply because I collect different things from Red Ryder, different signs and things like that. I'm a geek. I'm a nerd. I mean, I think it shows.
And so are we all, I'm sure.
Yes. Yeah,
so we're all here.
That being said.
All right, now.
Who's Carl Stalling, my friend?
Carl Stalling. Now, some of you have probably watched cartoons and seen his name, but maybe you didn't realize you saw his name. So, the weird thing, if you go down 34th Street, like I was talking about earlier, and you go around Troost, you're going to see this kind of a weird thing drawn on the side. You'll see a picture of Walt Disney, a really badly drawn Mickey Mouse head, and a thing that says Isis Theater. Now, the Isis Theater was a silent movie house. Carl Stalling played music at that silent movie house, and that's where the Laugh-O-Grams were shown, is over there. But we'll get into some of those details, because Carl Stalling, when I get into what he did later, you're going to be like, oh! I expect to hear a collective, oh! to where it, like my ears are just gonna pop. So I expect that. It's believe this is awesome. Okay, but he's born Lexington, Missouri in 1888. And actually at a very young age, he started playing with a broken piano toy and actually developed his love of composing music playing with a broken piano toy. That's prodigy. Saw the Great Train Robbery at age 5 and fell in love with the cinema. Now, that's one of the most famous silent films, other than the one that's the Ku Klux Klan. I call them the Cuckoo Klan, but that works. But they had made a very famous silent film. But the Great Train Robbery is one of the first ones that actually had story as a big thing in silent film. So now he meets Walt, of course, because he's the organist over at the Isis Theater. So a Laugh-O-Gram cartoon's coming in there that Walt makes, and Carl's going to come up with some music, and he's going to play music for it. Now, Laugh-O-Gram, of course, as we've gone through every one of these artists, closes down. So what happens to Carl Stalling? Well, he goes ahead and he goes to work with Walt and Roy and starts composing music for the first Silly Symphony. Anybody know what the first Silly Symphony was? Yes! I heard it right there, Skeleton Dance! So Carl Stalling wrote that song, and I love that music. So yes, Skeleton Dance, and that's part of a pair of shorts that he had an agreement that he was going to score. And even once, I found it noted online that he did do a voice for Mickey at some point. I don't know what cartoon it was, but somebody said that he did dub Mickey one time. It was probably where Mickey had like one line, which, just for fun, anybody know what the first word Mickey Mouse actually ever said was? Hot dog. He was a hot dog vendor. I can't remember what cartoon it is. Because if you look at Steamboat Willie, he doesn't actually say anything. It's more playing music. So anyways, but Carl Stalling develops a technique that they call ticking. And what he does is everybody in the orchestra has headphones on and they hear a metronome tick. So it keeps them all together. So if they can't see that baton, they don't have an excuse. They have a tick in their ears. So in 1930, he goes to work with Ub Iwerks on Flip the Frog. That's something Ub Iwerks started doing on his own. 1936, this is where it's going to get interesting, as if it wasn't already. He goes to work for Warner Brothers and becomes the animation department's musical director for over 20 years at Warner Brothers. Carl Stalling wrote that song that we all love to hear, and I'm not going to sing anymore.
Thank you.
Carl Stalling. Although one of them, Merry Melodies, was actually based on Merry Lou We Roll Along, but the Looney Tunes theme is completely original. And I just lifted some stuff from AllMusic.com because they have a nice thing, so I'm going to try to read this as interesting as I can. So from AllMusic.com, Stalling's arrival coincided with an emergence of a golden age of Warner Animation under the supervision of producer Leon Schlesinger, which we've mentioned him a lot of times already, who assembled a crack team of animators including Robert McKimson, Bob Clampett, Chuck Jones, I know y'all know Chuck Jones, oh yeah, Tex Avery, come on, where's my cartoon people? And Frank Tashlin. I have no idea that guy, though. The studio's cartoons, the Merry Melodies and Looney Tunes series, respectively, heralded a new era of inspired lunacy with a stable of memorable characters like Daffy Duck, Porky Pig, as well as a brand of anarchic comedy far removed from Disney's gentility. And with the 1937 arrival of voiceover master Mel Blanc, the nucleus of the studio's team was complete, and with the 1940 introduction of the character who later evolved into Bugs Bunny, the Warner Brothers flagship icon was born. So at Warner's, Stalling scored some 600 cartoons in all. In addition to creating their distinctive opening sound effect, you know, they listed it on there, they call it boing, but we know that sound, you know. Yeah, so he achieved via an electric guitar chord. He also established their distinctive theme song using Merrily We Roll Along for the Merry Melody series and the Merry-Go-Round Broke Down for Looney Tunes. Which, it's hard to remember like the difference between the two songs off the top of my head, but yeah. I'm not humming that one either.
Yeah.
But that's Merrily
We Roll Along. Yeah, you're right, they sound very similar.
It's hard to distinguish, but there is a difference between Looney Tunes and Merry Melodies. Anyway, so working with Warner's 50-piece orchestra under the direction of director Milt Franklin, Stalling scored each cartoon in about 3 hours at a staggering rate of at least one a week, absorbing the influences of current pop hits, classical symphonies, and the like, and then quoting whatever seemed fit over time, motifs began developing in his work. Drunken characters commonly stumbled about to the strains of How Dry I Am. Bugs Bunny's frequent appearances in drag were heralded by The Lady in Red, and Bouts of Hunger were accompanied by the obscure Billy Rose number, A Cup of Coffee, A Sandwich, and You. So he took popular songs and he actually made, you know, we didn't grow up with some of these old songs, but we would know if we hear, and I always think it's called like the machine, but when you hear, whatever the other machine you're going on, that was a popular song at the time, and he just said, well, we use that. That's a Warner Brothers song. So he made a lot of songs popular. He took classical songs, as I mentioned, and so we've heard a lot of classical music that we didn't realize was classical because we were watching Looney Tunes. There's actually a great YouTube channel, this German guy, that when he starts playing a song, he'll... because he doesn't really speak good English, but he'll play a song, and he's got some videos that he labels classic songs that you know, but you didn't know the name of, and he'll play a lot of these songs. Some of them you probably heard in Looney Tunes, and he'll put what the name of it is on, like, oh my gosh, I knew Beethoven. I didn't know I knew Beethoven, but thank you, Bugs Bunny. You taught me Beethoven.
I listen to a lot of classical music whenever I'm tired or whatever. I love classical music, but the funny thing is I'm trying to read what it is, you know, whatever it could be, Beethoven, Mozart, a key of this or this. I don't know that name. A lot of times, like Daffy Duck running from so-and-so is what I call it. This is just the way it is.
Yeah, because you hear that bit and like, wait a minute.
That's just it for me.
So, Isidore Friz Freleng.
Oh, okay.
Some of you probably
Isidore Friz Freleng. August the 21st, 1906, in Kansas City, Missouri, was born.
In Kansas City.
That's exactly right. One of our own.
This guy's one of the greatest of the nation.
Met Walt Disney in United Film at Service. How'd they do this? Through UB Iwerks. We know UB. We love UB. Yeah, we're going to learn more about him soon.
Later.
And through Hugh Harmon, who introduced Walt as the Laugh-O-Gram was ending. And unfortunately, Laugh-O-Gram didn't make it. We talked about that one.
Yeah, it only lasted about a year and a half.
Exactly. It didn't last very long. But we still love what the Laugh-O-Gram did.
So,
after Laugh-O-Gram, they followed Walt Disney to Los Angeles in 1923. In fact, it was about 7 months later.
Yeah, Friz Freleng kind of held back a little bit. And I kind of think what might have been part of the reason is, you know, he didn't get a chance to really work too much in Laugh-O-Gram. But he had already met UB Iwerks and Hugh Harmon, and Walt suddenly crashes a business. Now, suddenly Walt gets this contract in California. He's going to do this Alice Comedies. Sends word out to Hugh Harmon and UB Iwerks. Oh, hey, come join me on this. They go find Friz Freleng and say, hey, Walt Disney, he's got himself a contract. He's got a new company, and we're going to make Alice Comedies. Friz Freeling's like, wait a minute. Didn't that guy just bankrupt a company?
That's right.
I kind of like getting paid when I work. And didn't he, like, not pay you guys because he didn't have enough money to pay you? So I bet that's what he was thinking while there was a seven-month delay after they went that he finally decided, all right, I'm coming. Because that's a big move from Kansas City to California. So I have a feeling he was like, okay, I'm doing it.
So after going to California and working on the Alice Comedies and Oswald the Lucky Rabbit, then everything was taken by Margaret Winkler and Charles Mintz.
Mainly Charles Mintz.
Mainly Charles Mintz. And they went to New York, and unfortunately, Friz went with them. And so that happened. They didn't believe that Harmon and Ising series would be very successful. And so, after he went there, he worked on Crazy Cat. I don't know if any of you ever heard of Crazy Cat. I've seen bits and pieces of it. Pretty much, let's just be honest, a copy off of Felix.
Yeah, I figured they were doomed from the start because you're trying to make another cat character when Felix is popular.
Yeah, it didn't work out very well.
Not a good idea.
Y'all know who Felix is, all right?
Yeah, Felix the cat, the wonderful, wonderful cat.
We love that cat. And then he then moved back to California when Harmon and Ising sold to Warner Brothers. He then joined on to Warner Brothers in 1930 and became full-time director in 1933. Walt would see I. Freeling and credited on cartoons, and he would call him, what did he call him again?
I.P. Freeling. Walt and Friz Freeling didn't quite get along, and it probably had something to do with Walt was big on loyalty.
Yes, he was.
So when his artists get wooed away by Charles Mintz and ditched him to go work Oswald, because Oswald was still going to be getting produced over there with Charles Mintz and Universal, Walt didn't take it very kindly.
It was a slap in the face in his
It was a heck of a slap in the face. So when Walt would see, he'd go to a movie and he'd see a Looney Tune in there and see it directed, and you'll see these lines, he'll say I.P. or I. Freeling. Walt would always apparently say to somebody, okay, I.P. Freeling directed this one.
So, that being said, when
Charles Humor, man, that's Walt. He never grew up.
When he went to Warner Brothers, though, he then created or at least redesigned a few characters like Bugs Bunny, Porky Pig, Yosemite Sam.
Which I had my note in the wrong spot. Yosemite Sam was actually kind of inspired by the look of Friz Freleng, because Friz Freleng was noted as being short, red-haired, and having a bad temper.
So when you see Yosemite Sam from now on, you will know it is actually Friz Freleng.
Yeah.
So think about that next time you see him go, oh, you
what the fat for a fool, fat for a fool.
You'll say it's I.P. Freeling.
Yes.
That's him.
Well, you would wet yourself when that many times falling off the cliff because Bugs Bunny tricked you in that thing again until you learn to control your temper.
Well, that's probably true.
I don't get mad no more.
Thor ain't got the heart to tell him the money's gone.
That's right.
I love that cartoon.
And so he also recreated or redesigned, or at least created, characters like Sylvester. Y'all know Sylvester the cat.
Mm-hmm.
And then also Tweety Pie. Now, wait, notice we said Tweety Pie,
right,
not Tweety Bird. There's a reason that was his original name.
Yep, and he was originally pink because he was supposed to be a featherless little hatchling.
But that looked kind of disgusting. So
yeah.
They then changed. It did. It looked good. I've seen that one.
Yeah, it's weird when you see the little pink bird. You're like, why is he pink?
And then they changed it to yellow.
He's Tweety Bird now.
Yeah, they changed it to Tweety Bird.
And he's an annoying. I've never liked Tweety Bird.
You don't like Tweety Bird?
I don't like Tweety Bird. He's cute.
He's cute. We'll have to disagree on that one.
Yeah.
And then they.
Tom and Jerry. I root for Tom.
I like
Jerry. Him. Usually starts the fight.
Yeah, he also ends it.
Yeah, he does. Jerry's vicious.
Yeah, I love them both. He then stopped directing in 1936, and he was joined by Fred Tex Avery. He joined by him in 1937. They won 4 Oscars at Warner Brothers and moved to MGM to work on Captain and the Kids. He was offered almost double the pay that Leon Schlesinger was paying him at Warner Brothers, a series of shorts based off of a comic strip, but it was not successful.
Yeah, I never found out what comic strip that was he was doing at MGM, but it just didn't take off, so that's probably why I couldn't find anything. They just probably swept it under the rug, like, oh, with that Fritz Frelick, he's done all these great Looney Tunes. Let's have him do a new series at MGM. It stinks.
He then returned to Warner Brothers in 1939 and stayed until Termite Terrace Studio was closed in 1963.
Now, I'm thinking Termite Terrace was maybe a playful name that some of the artists had for the Warner Brothers Animation Studio. I couldn't find anything else, but it was noted as Termite Terrace, which sounds like something that maybe was, you know, poorly constructed and it was a little nickname.
Yeah, probably.
All right, because this is a long one, this is where I take over talking about Fritz Frelick. 1963, he co-founded DePaté Frelick Enterprises with David H. DePaté. Now, are these names starting to run familiar? Oh, Wolverine knows. Yeah. They subcontracted first to produce shorts for Warner Brothers, so they did some more Looney Tunes and Merry Melodies from 1964 to 1967. But then they produced and directed cartoons for television and theater. They animated the opening of the Pink Panther. Pink Panther, of course, becomes popular, so Frelick and DePaté start making Pink Panther shorts. The first one, The Pink Fink, in 1964, won Fritz Frelick his 5th Oscar. Then he starts producing shorts until he retires around 1981. Now get this, this is where the plot thickens. So in 1981, he wants to retire. Now you remember there was Marvel Productions, which was a division from Marvel, because Stan Lee really wanted to start getting animation going. So Marvel Productions, they started doing stuff, you know, they got Spider-Man and His Amazing Friends. Also, I think this is where they had a little bit of rights on Hulk Hogan, which was, I think, through Marvel Productions is what they...
Well, let me tell you something, brother, you better get it right.
Yeah. So Fritz Frelick sells his assets to Marvel Productions. So, now Marvel Productions is owned by the Walt Disney Company. So there are only a few things Fritz Frelick did on his own that Disney does not currently own. So see how this comes full circle? Now I've got a list. Okay, so from 1964 to 1967, when he was subcontracting for Looney Tunes, Warner Brothers still owns that. Those are their characters. The Dr. Seuss television specials made by DePaté and Frelick are owned by Warner Brothers. And the copyrights of the Pink Panther show and character are owned by MGM and United Artists. And then the fun thing is they did a Dr. Doolittle and Return to the Planet of the Apes, which is owned by 20th Century Fox. So guess who owns that now?
Now, is that one cartoon?
That was a couple different cartoons.
I was hoping so. I can't imagine Dr. Doolittle.
I heard there was a television series of Planet of the Apes. There's actually a podcast called Talking Apes that they're big fans of that series, and they went through like the entire thing. Also, though, the Tiny Tree is currently owned by AT&T, and AT&T is like buying up some studios now. I can't remember if they've got an acquisition. What's New Mr. Magoo is currently owned by DreamWorks Classics, NBC Universal, and Comcast, and The Bear Who Slept Through Christmas is currently owned by Lionsgate, but everything else they worked on, I have no idea what that is.
I love it.
It's currently owned by Disney. I would love it if Disney would have gotten a hold of Pink Panther and brought him back.
That'd be great.
I'd love it. Even if you just let Steve Martin be involved. An animated Steve Martin. Wouldn't that have been something? You know, redraw Inspector Clouseau, or at least let Steve Martin be the voice of Inspector Clouseau and make some new cartoons.
I would like to see Pink Panther in the Jungle Book. That, not joking. Oh,
that, yeah.
Baloo the Bear and Pink Panther.
Well, you know, they got that sequel coming out. Maybe we just said, like, hey, go and acquire the rights for the Pink Panther.
I'm joking. That'd be funny.
Oh, I, this is a weird fact. Okay, so Friz Freleng, one of the greatest animators, next to Ub Iwerks, who was the greatest animator of all time. Fight me? No, I'm kidding. You'd probably win. I'm a little guy. But he dies May 26, 1995 in Los Angeles. Now, May 26, 1995 is a very significant date for me. This is how weird my life is. I was born in 77, the exact day after Star Wars was released, just a couple months before Elvis died. So I was a replacement for Elvis. You're welcome. And then I turned 18 and graduated from high school on May 26, 1995, when Friz Freleng was dying. So apparently I was ready to move into adulthood and to replace Friz Freleng. You're welcome.
Are you still in adulthood? No.
No. One rule we have in Neverland is we never actually grow up. So. But yeah, thank you very much. But anyways, it is said, though, that he held a grudge against Walt Disney for having been fired at some point. He might have been fired from Laugh-O-Gram or something. I couldn't figure out exactly when he was fired. This Jim Corcus sent me out an email so that he held his grudge. But yet, he always did respect Walt Disney's work. So, see, it's impossible to not get along but have respect for each other. A lesson for your Facebook page.
Okay, the next one.
The fun name for you to say.
The next one is CarMax Max Maxwell. I have a hard time with it. I really do. CarMax Max Maxwell.
I bet that's why they called him Max. When you named CarMax, who a cruel parents you are. Your last name is Maxwell, and you name your kid CarMax.
It sounds like a Marvel character, doesn't it? Sounds like something Stanley would come up with. Yes,
CarMax Maxwell. So they just called him Max.
CarMax Max Maxwell was born December 27th, 1902, in Siloam Springs, Arkansas. Is that
Arkansas.
Right?
Arkansas. Okay. Yeah. We had to remember which one of the abbreviations. Because it's like AZ is Arizona, AK is Alaska, AR is Arkansas.
There you go. After Laugh-O-Gram, he went with Harmon and Ising on a proposed Arabian Nights series of cartoons. Now, this is not the same one that Warner Brothers, I mean, that Hanna-Barbera did.
Yeah, Hanna-Barbera had success on TV.
Now, this series never was sold. It never came out.
This is that failed business that Harmon and Ising tried to get going with.
Never had.
With CarMax Maxwell.
They worked.
I wonder what that idea was. I wonder if they were going to try to directly translate the books and make cartoons.
I wonder. But it never happened. So
never happened.
We'll never know. But he did work at Warner Brothers with Harmon and Ising at the beginning of the Warner Brothers animation. He was the voice of Bosco. Remember the one I did earlier?
Oh, Bosco!
I don't know if you've ever seen Bosco. You can find him once in a while. I actually have a few of them. But he was that voice. Basically, let's just be honest, it was a ripoff of Mickey Mouse. That's what it was. And if you're a fan of Seinfeld, you know Bosco, the little chocolate syrup, that I'm from what I understand was named after this little monkey guy. And that's what Bosco was. From what I understand, is what I read before.
Of course you would find a Seinfeld connection, wouldn't you?
Oh, you have to. Anyway, that being said, he went with harmonizing to MGM also. And after they were temporarily fired, he stayed at MGM as a production manager until 1953, and unfortunately he died on September 27th in 1987.
Now we get to do some fun. This lady is not really an animator. She's had a different role with Laugh-O-Gram. Virginia Davis. Some of you Disney fans might know her name. Maybe, maybe not. She was born December 31st, 1918. She was a Kansas native. She met Walt the summer of 1924. She was hired to play Alice in what's called Alice's Wonderland at Laugh-O-Gram. And this is now, it's kind of copyright free. This was sort of a test thing that Walt was doing. He had this idea of putting a live action person in a cartoon world. And if you get to see some of these clips, these are kind of adorable. At one point, you see him with little Alice Davis, and he's got this little thing, and they're watching animation like a doghouse or something. But then she goes into the cartoon. Well, this is the cartoon that Margaret Winkler sees in New York and says, hey, this has potential. And so when Walt's lost everything and he goes to California to go, you know, with a suitcase and a dream, as they say in Disney's California Adventure, this is the contract he gets to create Alice comedies from Margaret Winkler, which unfortunately also introduces him to Charles Mintz, and we've mentioned that earlier. So suddenly Virginia Davis has a job. Walt contacts Virginia and her mother and says, can you all move over to California? We're going to make some more. Yes, James, we see you. You missed the Seinfeld reference, James.
That's okay.
Anyways, so she starts working in California to make Alice comedies, also known at the time as Alice in Cartoonland. So in 1925, she retires from being Alice, and her final film was Alice in the Jungle. She's only age 7, and she's retiring. Then, she's not done acting. She played the role of Rezzy in The Greater Story in 1925, and this was the first National Pictures production. I don't know whatever happened to National Productions. I think we can get in 15 minutes. We just got to keep moving. Alrighty, so she signs a deal then with Harry Carey, and they work together in The Man from Red Gulch in 1925. She's still just 7 years old. 1929, she's cast in The Bluebird, which is a production that actually featured 150 children.
That's a lot.
She's age 11. And they tell you never work with kids. That's kids working with kids. 1934, she's 16 years old now, and she's performing as a dancer, and was actually uncredited in a 1936 film, College Holiday. And then, this is cool, because Walt must have just loved that little girl. So, she's all grown up. So she voice tests now for roles in Snow White and Pinocchio, but wasn't hired. I don't know who she was supposed to be in Snow White. I have heard in Pinocchio she was maybe going to be one of the little boys that gets turned into a donkey. So, but she also became the first woman named a Disney legend. Now, sources were saying it was in 1988 that she's actually named a Disney legend, but the Disney Legends website listed her in 1998. Now, I don't know if that's maybe when they started officially doing a ceremony, D23. I don't know why that discrepancy exists. I couldn't find anything. She did, however, pass away August 15, 2009 in Corolla, California, and your father got to meet her before he passed.
He sure did.
So
that was great for him. He was so thrilled to meet her.
But we got to tackle Ub Iwerks and
Ub Iwerks. You all sure have heard of Ub Iwerks.
Greatest animator.
Greatest animator and dear friends with Walt Disney.
Yep.
He was born March 24th, 1901, right here in Kansas City. And with the capital K, that rhymes with... No, I'm just kidding.
Keep going.
With Kansas City, Missouri. And how he met Walt was at age 18 at Pesman Rubin Commercial Art Studio in 1919, where he got to meet Walt. They failed to start a business together in 1920. They tried, of course, and it did fail, as we said.
That's before Laugh-O-Gram.
Before Laugh-O-Gram. Yeah. So as you can see, not everything worked out.
They tried, they failed, so they both went to work together at a different company.
That's right. And at the ad company.
Kansas City Film Ad Company, which is actually probably where he met the Harmons and Isaac.
Most likely. It joined Walt in the founding Laugh-O-Gram in 1922 as chief animator, and that also fails, as we said before.
Yeah.
But after Laugh-O-Gram, he went with Walt in 1923 and was animator behind the Alice comedies. Walt was requested by Charles Mintz, as we said before, the husband of Margaret Winkler, who made a deal to release Alice comedies to create a new character. Walt pitched the idea of the rabbit named Oswald, in which that Ub designed and animated Oswald the Lucky Rabbit. The deal was made for 7 shorts. Universal started releasing the Oswald in 1927. They weren't happy with the first short on or Oswald's design. So Oswald was streamlined a bit, and Walt gave Oswald more personality, something that he was a firm believer in, personality-driven stories in animation.
Yeah, apparently animation before that time, you would just have a character and maybe have a funny situation, but Walt says these characters need to have personality so you remember the character later.
So you could relate with them, too.
Right.
Something we could do and understand with.
Which is probably why Oswald was so popular at the time.
Yeah.
He was different.
In 1928, Universal and Charles Mintz wooed away most of Walt's animators and took the character away. Iwerks, however, stayed. Because Iwerks, like Walt, believed in a personal relationship with people and believed in loyalty.
Right.
Iwerks began drawing up ideas for a new character, frogs, dogs, cats, and etc. These ideas later would become Clarabelle the Cow and Horace Horse Collar. I'm sure most of y'all know those characters. Mm-hmm. I gotta admit, Horace is one of my all-time favorites. Doesn't get used like he ought to, in my opinion.
Yeah. Well, he came back and get a horse.
He did. Yep. He did, and I happen to love that. And how could you not? Get a horse, you got to have Horace.
You gotta have Horace.
In 1925, you have Hugh Harmon, who had sketched mice on a photo of Walt Disney.
Yeah, there's a little bit of backstory on that. So when Walt has Laugh-O-Gram Studio here on 31st Street, they had field mice always getting into the building. Walt would keep one in his drawer, and he taught it to follow his pencil around. So he played with this little mouse. So Hugh Harmon was just kind of being cute and had drawn a mouse on the picture of Walt. And when Walt's coming back on a train after he gets Oswald taken away, he says, "I need a new character." And he sent a telegram apparently to Iwerks, because Iwerks is working away all these, cats and frogs and everything. And Walt's thinking, a mouse. I need a mouse. So he sketches out something, and he's going to go and give that to Ub. So here, I've got a mouse thing. Do something. Finalize this.
So he did. And Walt came to Ub, who cleaned up and refined the design. And I think you've all seen it. You all probably have seen that design of Mickey.
Yeah.
We all know it. His name wasn't originally Mickey. You all know
it. It was going to be Mortimer.
Gonna be
Thank
Mortimer.
God Lillian said that's a terrible name.
Yeah. But that being said, later on, that name was used.
Yeah.
Have you ever seen that episode?
Mickey's Rival. I love that cartoon.
That's one of my favorites.
Mortimer.
In fact, Mortimer still gets used occasionally today.
Yeah.
They use Mortimer.
Yep.
He's got the long nose, has a little mustache.
He looks more like a rat.
Yeah, he does look a little more like a rat. And kind of is in personality-wise.
He's a jerk.
He is a creep.
I love that cartoon.
Yeah, I even like Mortimer, villain-wise.
Yeah.
That being said. Okay, so where am I here?
Well, I'll pick up a little
Go
bit
ahead,
here.
Brother.
So the fun thing is, Walt's still got a contract. He's got to make a total of 7 Oswald shorts. So he's still got his animators working on Oswald. So Ub Iwerks, by day, sitting there, yep, I'm drawing Oswald. Let me put that on the stack of Mickey Mouse things on there, because at night, Ub Iwerks is sitting there drawing Plain Crazy, the very first Mickey Mouse cartoon, although never released. Well, it was released later when they added sound.
Yeah.
But he was drawing it as a silent cartoon. Plain Crazy, it's funny. It's a lot of fun. Mickey Mouse building it. It's the most ridiculous building of an airplane you've ever seen. It's a lot of fun. But so he's drawing that at night, and then hiding Mickey Mouse drawings underneath Oswald drawings, because they're keeping that as secret as they can. They don't want anybody who, because they don't know who's loyal to Walt and who's being loyal to Charles, because Charles is wooing away those artists. It's like, we don't want Charles Mintz to know that we're about to kick his butt with a mouse. Because Charles Mintz couldn't get Oswald rolling. It was missing Walt's personality. And I've never seen any of the... I've seen some of the early Oswald ones. If you ever had the Epic Mickey game, they put some Oswald cartoons on there. They're hilarious. But when Universal was making Oswald, they couldn't get it going, which is why everybody forgot about Oswald, because he was a non-successful character anymore. And Walt suddenly comes out, he's got this Mickey Mouse. He couldn't get Plain Crazy to sell. After Ub actually finished 600, 700 drawings and completed the work in just mere weeks, Ub Iwerks animated that entire cartoon himself. And he did that, the Skeleton Dance, Steamboat Willie, Ub Iwerks animated those himself. This is why I call him the greatest animator ever. Prove me wrong. So... Oh yeah, we're moving on. I guess I just mentioned I can hop along. So of course you realize they didn't have success with Mickey until Walt thinks sound. Mm-hmm. So Steamboat Willie is the first one that actually finally gets released, and so we consider his birthday and anniversary to be Steamboat Willie. But after realizing, hey, we had some sound to this thing, they went back to Plain Crazy and another one that Ub Iwerks had animated, and they added some sound and music and then released those, which I think you can find some of those on YouTube. But now, unfortunately, you know, they're like best buddies. But all of a sudden, your best friend, you start nagging and annoying them. Because Walt was known as a bit of a harsh taskmaster. So Ub had a little bit of a falling out with him. And just to really irritate Walt, there's this guy, Pat Powers. And he has developed the Powers Cinephone sound-on system, in which Powers actually had copied from another guy in the DeForest Phono film. Pat Powers said Walt had used his stuff to put sound to cartoons, and he had already had a falling out then with Walt, because I think he had been working with this guy, but they already had a falling out. So Ub Iwerks, after he has a falling out with Walt, goes to work with Pat Powers, who promises Ub Iwerks his own studio under his own name. And Ub Iwerks probably could have made that work, and he did get a few things going. So Iwerks actually created a multi-plane camera out of car parts from a junkyard. Now, Iwerks loved, of course, working on cars. So when he returns to the studios, he actually does use his experience to improve what Disney had as a multi-plane camera. Now, how many of you are familiar with the multi-plane camera? All right, a few of you. Okay, so go back and watch. I think some of the one of my favorites is in Bambi. The opening shots of Bambi, you're moving through a forest, and everything moves at different speeds, so it gives it that 3D effect. That's a multi-plane camera. If you imagine a big box from floor to ceiling, the camera's up here on the ceiling, and you're moving there's like different glass levels, and you're moving pieces of the background at different speeds across, so you're taking a shot, so it makes everything seem to move in different ways. So your background is not one picture, but multiple pictures. You see a beautiful example of this in the beginning of Pinocchio, when you scan out over the town and the village, and then suddenly the camera's able to move in and go down into the town. It's a beautiful shot, and we take it so much for granted now, but when you realize, wait a minute, these were multiple drawings that are suddenly now interacting with each other. It's impressive. You know, there's so much we can do on a computer these days, but there's that art is gone of being able to do this. So, Disney first had a multi-plane camera. Ub Iwerks has his developments, and when he comes back to Disney, because he did come back, he improves it. So MGM actually made a contract with Upworks to make Flip the Frog and Willy Whopper cartoons, but he actually never had the success that Disney did. So 1937, Leon Schlesinger, Mr. Warner Brothers, he contracts Iwerks to produce four Looney Tunes, which starred Porky Pig and Gabby Goat. Anybody remember Gabby Goat? Some of you do. I've actually seen Gabby Goat cartoons where I saw it again later, and Daffy Duck was in the place of Gabby Goat. Same script, but it was Daffy Duck. Gabby Goat, for whatever reason, did not catch on, but Daffy Duck did. So he actually did a little bit of contract work over at Scream Gems, which was part of, not Universal, but I got 5 minutes. So 1940, he returned to the Disney Studios, and he's one of the few that came back and was welcomed. So I have a feeling him and Walt, their friendship was strong enough, you know, that they got over it. Then, this is awesome. So Upworks worked on some of the effects, mixing some live action and animated characters for the 1946 Song of the South. Now, if you remember, he worked on those Alice comedies where you put a live little girl in the cartoon. Makes perfect sense. Song of the South, animation with live action actors. He was the pro. Then he starts working at Wed Enterprises, which is now known as Walt Disney Imagineering, and actually helped create some Disneyland attractions. He animated a deep sea illuminated fish for the 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea attraction, which unfortunately is now not there. That's a Nemo attraction in Disneyland. He got an Oscar for Alfred Hitchcock's The Birds in 1963. He starts doing effects animation. He died July 7th, 1971. Now, this is what we get cool now. The Annie Awards, I don't know, I don't have time to explain them. The Annie Awards are like animation awards, though. But they created an award in his honor called the Upworks Award for Technical Achievement. His sons ended up working for Disney and the camera department. And in 1989, he was named a Disney legend. And he actually had told his sons, "It doesn't make any difference who first drew Mickey Mouse. What made the difference was what Walt did to the character." Because a lot of people, they want to be able to fuss like, "Oh, Iwerks never gets credit for Mickey Mouse." Well, Iwerks does get some credit, but not everybody knows about Iwerks. Because you have to sometimes do a deep dive and show up with one of these things. But Iwerks was like, you know, I don't care if I got credit that I finished up the design. It was Walt's idea. And Mickey Mouse had Walt's personality.
And voice.
And his voice at first. Yeah. Which
gives enough time
we
for the very
4
last.
4 minutes, the very last. There's some weird dude called Walt Disney.
I never heard of him.
He's so obscure. He's born December 5th, 1901, but he worked at Laugh-O-Gram. Walt Disney met Walt Disney under a dreaming tree in Marshalline, Missouri.
Oh, I've heard of that place.
Yeah, that's where he starts dreaming up ideas. He tells stories to his sister. Little Ruth was said that Walt was the greatest storyteller that she ever met.
Wonderful.
But he would imagine, and he would draw the animals he would see. He even drew on the side of the house in tar. They actually have it. If you ever get a chance to see the museum in Marceline, they've recreated that. It's really fun.
Wonderful.
But you know what? After Laugh-O-Gram failed, he went to California with a suitcase and a dream, moved into his uncle's house, persuaded his brother Roy to get out of his sick bed to join him. Roy Disney had tuberculosis, was lying in a bed, wasting away. Walt shows up and says, I've got a contract to do these Alice comedies, but I don't have the sense to run the finances. Roy, you got to get up. So he got Roy up out of bed, and Roy actually started recovering when he had purpose with his brother. Roy Disney is an unsung hero to the Disney company.
Uh-huh.
And I love it. Walt Disney World, there's a little bench you can sit next to a Roy Disney statue and you take a picture with it. I've got a photo.
Roy
Disney
Mouse.
I guess with my buddy Josh, I got a picture with Roy Disney. I love the picture, but Roy Disney is the hero of Disney. Walt was a creative guy, but he didn't have enough business sense. Roy knew how to get it going. Although Roy frequently would like to tell Walt, no, we don't have the money for that, which is actually why Walt would start other companies. Like Wed Enterprises, which is now in Imagineering, was something Walt created when he went to Roy and said, "I'm going to build a theme park." Roy said, "What's a theme park?" "No." Walt said, "I'm going to do it." So a lot of things, Walt bankrupted himself quite a few times.
That's right.
But that stuff usually he did on his own. He turned it into successes later. He, of course, started a Disney Brothers company in his uncle's garage, summoned Virginia Davis from Kansas to come and be a star of Alice comedies, and from there, made history. I don't know if anybody's got any questions, because I got 2 minutes. Fire away. Oh.
You're telling me all of these artists got their start at Laugh-O-Gram?
Yes. All at Laugh-O-Gram. I love doing this research. I had kind of the idea in the back of my head, what am I going to do at Planet Comic Con this year? I'm like, all these other artists that worked at Laugh-O-Gram, what did they do? And then I started looking through, and I was like, we wouldn't have Looney Tunes if not for perhaps the influence of Walt Disney on harmonizing and Fritz Freleng. I don't know how much influence he had because they didn't get along. But I do a lot of driving for Lyft and Uber. And they'll say, well, tell me something about Kansas City nobody knows. I said, Walt Disney got his start here at Laugh-O-Gram Studio. It failed. And if it had not failed, who knows? We might be the hub of animation. I mean, because these guys who work with them, this is the animation we all came to know when we were kids. All the big pioneers were from here. It's amazing. Which, by the way, I don't need these notes. So if any of y'all wants to like be able to keep track of all these things, I will gladly give you some notes. I saw a hangover. Does that mean you want the notes? Okay. I will even sign them for you because I am that much of an egomaniac that I'm like, I'm internet famous. So we'll even sign them up for you. But if y'all want to be able to follow up on this, neverlandpodcast.com is where the website where I post the shows are there. Of course, we're on Apple Podcasts under Neverland to Disney and Beyond. This week, of course, we're going to have this audio because I've been recording it right here. And also a review of Dumbo because grown men will cry.
I did.
I promise you. What? The first half hour, once you get past the first hour, first half hour when he starts to take flight, you're just like, go Dumbo! And you act like you didn't know what was going to happen, but
it's good.
It's got some flaws I'll get into when I do a full review that I record later, but no, the first hour kind of retells the movie and then moves on to a brand new story when Michael Keaton shows up. But that's all the time we have. And so remember to keep that pixie in your pocket. Spread a little bit of that dust around. If you see somebody smiling, not smiling today, smile at them. Shake their hand. Be careful of putting a hand on your shoulder and saying, hey, how you doing? Because some people are like offended by that now. So it's hard to spread pixie dust. But sometimes you just got to smile and say, hey, it's good to see you. That's pixie dust. Little things. That's our philosophy. And that's our show.
God bless.
I feel like Porky Pig needs to come out there. That's all, folks. Well, thank you so much for coming. I love it when I have everyone to talk to.
There'll be spectacle, there'll be fantasy, there'll be daring do and stuff like you would never see.
Be a movie.
Yeah, we're gonna be a movie.
Starring everybody.
And me.
Boy, I wish I were you people seeing this for the first time.
Kermit, I got a great picture of the chicken.
All right, before we get into some more details of my review of the live version of Tim Burton's Disney Dumbo, I have some fun facts that are part of the press kit that I have here for Dumbo. And it says the basic story of Dumbo, we're talking about the animated film. The basic story actually dates back to 1939 as a planned novelty called a roll-a-book, which is a book with little knobs that readers turn to read the story through a window. And the authors were Helen Aberson and Harold Pearl, and they wrote the story Dumbo the Flying Elephant. Now, whether a roll-a-book was ever produced is a mystery because none of them have been located. But when Walt Disney purchased the rights to the story, he published 1,430 copies of a regular book version of the story. Dumbo was one of the first feature films finished at Disney's new Burbank studio lot, which opened in 1940. It was built thanks to profits from Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs. Now, Dumbo was originally slated as a 30-minute short film, and it ultimately expanded to just under 64 minutes, Disney's second shortest animated feature film behind 1942's Saludos Amigos, which was just 42 minutes. In the original animated film, Dumbo, who won the hearts of viewers around the world, doesn't speak, though Mrs. Jumbo, Timothy Mouse, and many other animals do. In Tim Burton's reimagining of the story, none of the animals speak. Although Mrs. Jumbo, I think, only has like one line in the film, doesn't she just call him Jumbo Jr.? She just gives him a name? I don't recall that she says anything else after that. It's some of the other elephants that are all gossips and everything. Now, as far as the live action goes, some more fun facts. Director Tim Burton studied animation at CalArts alongside a host of future Disney filmmakers, including Chris Buck from Frozen, John Musker, Moana, all kinds of stuff. John Musker, wow, he's got a lot of stuff. Just look him up. Mike Giacchino also worked on Frozen. Glenn Keane worked on Tangled. And Rich Moore, Ralph Breaks the Internet. Burton worked at Disney Animation in the early 1980s and directed two shorts for the studio, Vincent, and the live-action short, Frankenweenie, and later wrote and produced the 1993 stop-motion cult phenomenon, The Nightmare Before Christmas. Burton's 2010 reimagining of Alice in Wonderland won Oscars for Best Achievement in Costume Design, Colleen Atwood, and Best Achievement in Art Direction, Robert Stromberg, the production designer, and Karen O'Hara, the set decorator. The live-action reimagining of Dumbo utilizes state-of-the-art visual effects to portray Dumbo and many of his four-legged counterparts. Yeah, it seemed to be most of the time it was computer animated. You could kind of tell, but they still looked really good. Utilizing the design of the train in the animated film Dumbo, filmmakers behind the live-action reimagining constructed a full-scale Casey Jr. train for the film. However, since the Medici Brothers circus is far from new and shiny, the train had to be aged with chipped paint and wear and tear to aptly reflect the state of the circus. And I was totally hooked by the time when I first saw Casey Jr., because it has his face on the front of it and everything. Oh my gosh, it tapped right into my nostalgia. I really appreciated the details they put into creating Casey Jr. And even Danny Elfman's score, he kind of hints at the Casey Jr. song a little bit. It was really neat. Director Tim Burton and his production team wanted to honor the minimal and expressionistic look of the original animated film, and to bring the look into the live-action realm, they studied film noir and developed a stripped-down environments and lighting strategies, ultimately striking a balance between reality and expressionism. Dumbo was shot just outside of London on sound stages at Pinewood Studios East, becoming the second film to shoot in the new section of the famous film lot. Now, the production team built as much of the Medici Circuit Brothers Circus and Dreamland as possible to ground the story in the environment. Colin Farrell is no stranger to horses, having appeared in several films that required extensive horse riding, Alexander, Winter's Tale, among others, but when the Dumbo script described his character as a former circus star with a popular equestrian act, Farrell trained with a lasso and a horse riding instructor. And I'm starting to enjoy Colin Farrell more and more every time I see him in a film, I must say. He's just getting more and more entertaining. He's become really good at being kind of an everyman and yet father figure for both this film and for Saving Mr. Banks. I'm really enjoying Colin Farrell. Now, the props department armed Millie with books by physicist Marie Curie to showcase the character's passion for science. Nico Parker, who portrays Millie, I'm stumbling over my words, spent some time studying the books to better understand her character, but says she doesn't share Millie's scientific leanings. Yeah, they basically, I think they're trying to help encourage, you know, young women into science by creating characters like this. And so they made it a bit of a plot with Millie that she was very interested in science and had become interested while her father, played by Colin Farrell, Holt is his name, had been off fighting World War I and comes back missing an arm. And so he's supposed to be, oh, well, you can't really do your circus act anymore riding horses. And his wife had passed away while he was away from illness, the flu, they kind of mentioned. So you do have some nice family quality and a storyline going on with him and his two children. Now, actor Roshan Seth, who portrays snake charmer Premesh Singh, comfortably carried a live python around his neck in most scenes that featured him. Yes, and there are some funny scenes with the python. I think there's some stuff they did use computer or maybe some puppetry, perhaps, to have the snake do certain behaviors. But and I knew I'd seen this guy before. I think he was in Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom, looking at his face. But I'm not entirely certain about that. But I think he played one of the villain characters that first greets Indiana Jones and company at the town there. Wow, and it's gone out of my head. I can't think of the name of it, and everybody's probably yelling at their phone right now saying, no, it was this one. But I'm pretty sure that's him. I should have looked that up beforehand, but I mean, I was sitting there going like, wow, that guy looks so familiar. Was he in Indiana Jones? And I think that's who it is. But anyways, the tank that houses Miss Atlantis was constructed with double walls. A narrow internal tank that lined the bigger tank was filled with water and fish to create the illusion that she was underwater, which I think is how that freak show type of thing was supposed to work. She was supposed to be a mermaid, and she's kind of a larger lady, and she was such a great character. And in fact, in order to get Baby Mine to work as a scene, because they wanted to recreate the Baby Mine scene, and you know, they didn't want to have this film be kind of a musical where there was nobody there you could tell who's singing the song, because in the animated film the song's just there. But they had it and I know there's a term for this and I'm forgetting the term for it, but they had it, you know, in the environment the song is being performed. She's singing Baby Mine as Dumbo comes out to his mother, who's been locked away in a trailer that says Mad Elephant, and bring your tissues. They did such a great job of recreating that scene that if this scene has had an emotional impact on you in the animated one, this version will also create an emotional impact, even though it's still technically animated by computer. But it was fantastic. Now, Mrs. Atlantis' costume consisted of more of 100 overlapping scales, which were hand-stitched. There were alternating rows of black and turquoise. The scales were constructed from 3 to 4 layers of fabric with sequin borders to give each scale a reflective quality. And it was really neat looking. It did have that vintage early 1900s look. But yeah, it was kind of like this nice mermaid costume. It was really cool. Now, in the film, Ivan the Wonderful and Catherine the Greater are a husband and wife team of illusionists who care for Millie and Joe after their mother passes and before their father returns from the war. Real-life couple Miguel Menuez and Zenaida Alcan, I'm probably getting her name wrong, they portray the duo. And the Spanish performers specialize in physical theater, trapeze, and magic. And I think they did some actual sleight of hand stuff that they had in the film. I mean, they could have used effects, certainly, but it was some really neat stuff. They were minor characters, but they were enjoyable. Now, filmmakers felt strongly about featuring real circus performers to infuse a sense of authenticity to their circus. Fourth-generation circus performer Christian Christoph from Hungary was hired to share not only his extensive knowledge of the circus, but his international circus connections. The result was a multicultural array of performers, including jugglers, clowns, knife throwers, contortionists, a dog trainer, and more. And it was neat. I mean, there's a lot of good circus, you know, acrobatics and all kinds of stuff in this film. It was really cool. The circus troupe assembled for the film hailed from all over the world. The significant language barriers made it difficult for the performers to connect, and that is until they set up a ping pong table. Now, Eva Green portrays aerialist Colette Marchand, but the actress joined the production with a serious fear of heights. A professional aerialist was hired to double for Green as needed and worked with the actress to build her confidence in the air. In the end, Green conquered much of her fear and was able to perform a lot of the choreography. And you can tell watching the film when it wasn't her, because the who was filling in for her would be looking away from the camera, looking down, so you wouldn't see her face. Now, to play the role of aerialist Colette Marchand, Eva had to exude not only the physique, but the fluidity such a performer would embody. Personal trainer and aerialist Francesca Janes was tapped to work with Green. One of the strategies employed to build strength and elegance was ballet. And Eva Green really does have this very elegant maneuver, and especially when she's supposed to be performing at her role in the circus, the way she would gesture was... It was big, but it wasn't like... over the top big circus thing, you know. It seemed very natural and very elegant. She did a great job. In the film, Millie and Joe, these are the two kids, have a little mouse circus, which is a nod to Timothy Q. Mouse in the animated movie. And in fact, we did mention in the trailers a little white mouse that has kind of the band leader uniform, which they don't call him Timothy, but that's Timothy. Now, since Dumbo, Mrs. Jumbo, and the other elephants in the film are added in post-production by visual effects department, the production team had to build on-set stand-ins for fellow performers to act opposite. And lifelike replications were created in some cases to assist in lighting certain scenes, and in other cases, crew members dressed in green, making them easy to remove in post, and carried elephant-sized frames to demonstrate where the elephants would ultimately be placed. Green stuffies and elephant suits were also created to help establish eye lines. Sharon Rooney, who plays Miss Atlantis, was tapped to sing the iconic song Baby Mine in the film. The song holds a special place in Rooney's heart. Her grandmother used to sing it over her when she was a child. Rooney also had to play the ukulele for the scene, and she'd never picked up the instrument before, and it took her just a week to learn to play the song. And Sharon Rooney, if you ever hear this, you did great. For Dreamland's parade sequence, costume designer Colleen Atwood's team created more than 200 costumes for the performers, plus an additional 500 for the crowd characters. The team behind the elephant's animation pushed available technology to the next level, adding sliding skin, flexing muscles, and jiggling fat to give the animals a sense of mass. And yes, these elephants were very believable when you looked at them. The effects were really good because, you know, we've all seen an elephant before. And so creating one in a computer, I mean, we can tell it's created in a computer, but it looked very real, very believable. And you mainly just reacted to them as characters, even Dumbo, because Dumbo has, of course, these big blue eyes, which are not very much elephant eyes. He's got character eyes. Now, I mentioned in the panel you heard that I really did enjoy this movie, but I have a couple of things to criticize. To basically lay down the film, like the first half of the film is pretty much recreating in its own way the original film. And then it picks up and shifts gears to a new story when Michael Keaton shows up as his character, which I'm not sure what they were doing with his character, because he at times he quotes Walt Disney on, it's, you know, the impossible is possible and stuff like that. He seems like a decent fellow, but there's something weaselly about him, and he's kind of a little over the top. He's a little bit P.T. Barnum mixed with Walt Disney. And when we mentioned Dreamland here, I was going over these notes. Dreamland is almost like he's built his own Disneyland. And he's got a banker that he is beholden to, played by Alan Arkin, which it's always fun to see him pop up. I can't think of any other Disney films he's done off the top of my head other than The Rocketeer. He has a great role in The Rocketeer. But Alan Arkin plays a banker that is basically funding Dreamland and this big standing circus, which kind of reminded me of Cirque du Soleil, the way it was set up, because his circus is stationary. It doesn't travel. It has a location of where it's at, and it's inside of basically a theme park. So him being kind of villainous, it almost felt like this movie was taking jabs at Walt Disney. Now, maybe they weren't thinking of it that way. Maybe they weren't paying attention to what they did, but it's like, wow, you established a character who's kind of like P.T. Barnum, but you have him quote Walt Disney a few times. And then you take, you know, him as the bad guy, and you have him kind of a jerk. I'm like, wow, that's... You realize you almost kind of insulted the guy that started this company that made this film? So that's, I think that's a bit of a mistake. They should not have made him quote Walt Disney, or even have a park and even have a section that was like the Carousel of Progress, that was sort of a plot point for Millie, who is very interested in science, and she has a good scene with her father of, you know, all the things she's amazed with of science, and she's got a little bit of Walt's fascination of what the future may hold because of things, you know, technology is, you know, progressing and stuff like that. So that might have been a misstep. And also, I did see the effects of a film where, you know, there are people who consider the crows to be racist characters. And there's also a large group of animal activists that they don't, you know, elephants in the modern world have been removed from circuses. So there's no way they could really create the happy ending of, yay, Dumbo gets his mother back, she's got her own special car, and they're traveling the circus, and they're famous. They couldn't do that ending because those animal activist people would probably have been upset with that ending. So they do a different ending, which doesn't make sense. Now, I don't want to spoil things, so I've got to be careful about this, but they do establish at one point, and this happens in actual animal kingdom. I have seen even at San Diego Zoo of a water buck that was born albino, and the other water bucks were a little afraid to be around it. They were like, oh no, there's something different about this. And they have a moment, and they kind of are replicating the three female gossiping elephants with one scene where they see Dumbo's ears, and they're like, oh, that's a freak thing. Oh, destroy it. So I'm just going to throw this question out there. Would you take this baby elephant with large ears who, you know, a herd mentality is going to take over, and they're going to be like, oh, there's something wrong with your baby. Why would you bring that out to a bunch of other elephants in the wild? That doesn't make sense. Also, simply putting two elephants on a boat does not make them get to the jungles of India. So I have a problem with the ending. It doesn't make sense, but then again, a flying elephant doesn't make sense either. So I have problems with kind of a weird turn that it takes, which it felt like an appeasement ending. And it was a nice ending. It's nice to have Dumbo's reunited with his mother, which if that shouldn't be a spoiler, because unless you've never seen the original Dumbo, you're going to know that it's all going to work out good and Dumbo will be reunited with his mother, that kind of thing. But the way they did it, it was like, I felt like it was like, oh, yay, but okay. You know, I understood why they went with the ending they did, but it didn't completely jive. It seemed like a weird left turn from the rest of the film, because a lot of the rest of the film is, it's Dumbo, like, he's partially has to kind of prove himself, his own value, and then he's doing stuff trying to, he just wants his mother freed and wants to be reunited with his mother, and so he does get that. It's just kind of a weird way that they did it, I think, and I think I know the reasons behind it, but still a very enjoyable film. I really liked it so far. I think this may be probably my favorite of the remakes that Disney has put out. I really enjoyed it. I got very emotionally involved with it. So, oh my gosh, bring tissues. Even if you're a 40-year-old man, bring tissues. Because if you have any fondness for this original film or love the character of Dumbo, they go right for the heartstrings. Tim Burton has done a wonderful job. I really enjoyed the cast. This was a very good film, and I highly recommend it. But now, it's time we wrap this up. So I'm going to say goodbye for now, and we'll see you next week. And for those of you who are new to the show, thanks for downloading. Make sure you visit NeverlandPodcast.com. If you click on Neverlanders, you can choose yourself a nickname and become an official Pixie or Lost Boy, because, you know, girls don't get lost. They're too clever. Also, we do have a Patreon page that you can go and support. I do appreciate it. You can do as little as a dollar or up to $5. I don't ask any more than that. That really does help me out. Also, we do have a Facebook page you can come and follow. There's a Facebook group you can join. I try to post more into the regular page than I do in the group. I need to put more stuff into the group. We also have a Twitter at NeverlandPcast, which I think that's also where the Instagram is. We are having some fun on Twitter as well. So come and follow us everywhere and interact. There's a YouTube channel. I try to post up some videos every once in a while. We're having a good time. And I'm going to have probably some video of what I've done here at Planet Comic Con. At some point, but right now I think I want to release the video of the panel a little early to the Patreon supporters, and then eventually we'll probably put that up on YouTube, but I want to share that with Patreon support first. But anyways, come back next week, we're going to have even more fun, and I'm probably going to share more stuff from Planet Comic Con, or possibly, depending upon when he contacts me, I got to meet a guy who designed the costumes and the look for most of the human characters in the Star Wars prequels. I stumbled into this panel. I wasn't familiar with this guy, and I learned so much, and I gave him my card and invited him to come to the show, so I'm hoping he contacts me, because I would love to talk to him and for you to hear all the neat things that he has done. It was a great panel. I really enjoyed it. But that's okay. Finally, final word, I am going to wrap this up, and I'm going to see you next week. Thanks for downloading and listening. Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to the Neverland Podcast.
We invite you back next week for more fun and adventure.
Until then, remember to keep a pixie in your pocket.
It's that young at heart, positive attitude that you can share with others.
And remember to visit our website at neverlandpodcast.com.
There you can find links to our news page, our shop,
our contact page, where you can easily send an email to podcast@neverlandpodcast.com.
You can also find our Neverlanders page, where you can find out how to become an official Lost Boy or Pixie, because girls are too clever to get lost.
Become a real Neverlander.
Please feel free to leave us a voicemail at 816-226-6492.
And be sure to follow us on Twitter at NeverlandPcast.
And like our Neverland Podcast fan page on Facebook.
We also have a group on Facebook for you to join.
We also appreciate your support to keep the Neverland Podcast up and running.
Visit patreon.com/neverlandpodcast to donate to keeping the pixie dust alive.
Copyright content featured on the Neverland Podcast is copyright of their respective creators and used under fair use license.
All original content is copyright of Blue Band Productions, and a very special thanks to Yeehaw Bob Jackson at yeehawbob.com for our new ending music.
God bless!
Yeah! Hello everybody, this is Yeehaw Bob Jackson. Neverland Podcast, we love you. Neverland Podcast, we love you. Neverland Podcast, it's true. Neverland Podcast, we love you. Yeah!
This is the story of the one. As a maintenance engineer, he hears things differently. To the untrained ear, everything on his shop floor might sound fine, but he can hear gears grinding or a belt slipping. So he steps in to fix the problem at hand before it gets out of hand. And he knows Granger's got the right product he needs to get the job done, which is music to his ears. Call, click Granger.com, or just stop by. Granger, for the ones who get it done.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.